2 degrees Kenosha, 21 in Racine, sunshine and a wind chill of 8 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And I can't imagine someone not recognizing that music after just a few moments of hearing it. That is, of course, the music which opens the beloved 1939 film version of The Wizard of Oz. By the way, this recording is of the original overture that was created for the opening night screening of The Wizard of Oz, a score that was uncovered a few years ago after decades having been lost and forgotten. And anyway, we're playing just a few moments of that to get us all in the mood for something really special in downtown Kenosha. Opening tomorrow night and running for 3 weekends will be the stage adaptation of The Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum and the wonderful score of E.Y. Harburg. And joining me today in this portion of the morning show are three people very, very busy with the Lakeside Players and their production of Wizard of Oz. I'm speaking with the co-stage directors, Colin Swanson and China Chung, and music director Brian Chung, and they are taking time out of what I'm sure is an incredibly busy final week of rehearsals in anticipation of tomorrow night's opening night performance. A warm welcome to all three of you to the morning show. Thank you for making time for this.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to have you aboard. I want to mention parenthetically that this is a show that means a lot to me because way back in fifth grade, I was the Tin Man. And a few years later, my brother Steve was the Scarecrow in a completely different production. And a few years later, my niece was Toto and so on. So that this runs deeply in the Berg family. And I'm just curious for each of you, if you had any direct experience with The Wizard of Oz before taking on the responsibility of this production with the Lakeside Players.
Actually, our choreographer, she's not with us, but Kelly Marie, it was her first show ever that she was in when she was a tiny one. And so she actually approached us and asked if she could be part of the team because the show was so special to her. And she actually put in our choreography, a couple little nods to when she was a little tiny munchkin in the show and some of that choreography that she learned when she was really small. So she had a really deep connection to it. The rest of us, we've always loved it. We've seen it pretty much anytime we could see it. I know my family, we watched it a lot around like Christmas or holidays. We would always watch Wizard of Oz. So that's kind of my connection to it. Mm-hmm.
How about the other two, Colin Swanson?
Well, I remember my aunt had a Dorothy dress, and I used to put it on when I was little, and I'd run around the house singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and I used to put on performances on our fireplace, and it was always the Wizard of Oz Dorothy dress that I loved, so searching for the right dress for this production was crucial for us.
Very good. How about you, Brian? Is that your story as well, or is there a variant on it?
Both, yeah. No, actually, I've only seen the movie and the soundtrack. Other than that, I don't really have like a very close connection with that. But, of course, the soundtrack is really great, classic. You can't not recognize it. You got those very familiar songs, Over the Rainbow, of course. And then you got We're Off to See the Wizard. And it's just really great. It's been a great show. We love directing the show.
Yeah, it's really incredible start to finish. I have to say one other involvement that I've had with The Wizard of Oz is a few years ago when it was done at Bradford High School, and I'm not positive if that was a Kenosha Unified production or some other group, but in the auditorium at Bradford, and that production very suddenly at the last minute lost their pianist in the pit because of illness or something. And I rode to the rescue at the very last minute, feeling pretty confident because I really knew this score fairly well. But honestly, I had no idea how complicated some of it was, some of the musical numbers that are sung and some of the stuff that's not sung, but the kind of the tornado music and the flying monkey music and so on. This is a really sophisticated score, and I came away from that night at the piano very humbled by just how complicated the score is. Can you talk for a moment, Brian, about the challenges that that this has posed as well as the pleasures?
Yeah, no, there was a lot of challenges, especially with like the lesser-known numbers that is featured in the film, but not so much in terms of like being in the forefront in the scenes, especially like scenes like the poppy scene.
Mm.
We have the poppy singing in our production of it, but it's not really... I wouldn't say like people would recognize it right off the bat, but like it was pretty difficult to get those harmonies in there. It's very tight, and you got different themes going on as well. I recognize that the main characters had like a theme going on, so we tried to work with that in terms of the staging and the blocking with that. So that was a really neat trip down like music theory of motifs and all that.
Right, there you go. Right, and there's I think what you're pointing to is the fact that although most people know the big headline songs of Wizard of Oz, there is more to this score than that. And it sounds like you are lavishing a lot of care on this entire score. China and Colin, what can you tell us about the selection of this to be part of the series, the part of the season for the Lakeside Players? And did either of you have a hand in this being chosen?
Yes, I, back last year, before the season was chosen, I met with the current president, Katie Gray, and one of the board members. And we went to dinner and we started discussing what shows should be on the season. And then I asked if I could come into the theater because it's been years since I've been in this theater. And I stood on stage and I just threw out a couple titles that ended up being on our season, which was The Addams Family, Wizard of Oz, and Beauty and the Beast. And all three of those shows happened to be chosen. And I applied to direct them, and then I got selected to be the director. And then I brought China on for this production because I'm also directing a few other musicals right now at different locations. And I wanted to build a strong team around us so that we could put on the best show. But, yeah, it's a big show to take on in a very minimal rehearsal process. Some of our actors didn't even come until January 1st, or 3rd, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Our Wicked Witch and Wizard, because we were doing choreography and music, and they aren't in any of the music or choreography numbers. So we've been really putting a lot of work into it in a short amount of time.
Wow. One of the interesting challenges for you, of course, is working within this beautiful, charming, but also limited space of the Rhodey Opera House. That is limited in terms of the sheer size of the stage and the space that is available to you off stage and that kind of thing. I mean, it is a space that poses challenges for any director and designer. And I should think particularly with a show as big as The Wizard of Oz. Talk for a moment about that challenge and how maybe it's been both a challenge and also kind of fun to work with that space and make it work for you as best you can with your large cast.
Yeah, so we, in terms of the scenic design, Edward Skinner and I, Edward is our scenic designer and myself as the director, we talked in September about the scenic design, and we designed two large turrets, which are like turntables, that turn, so we are able to load in set pieces, and then they just spin, and the sets are on stage. And then we also built a house that is 8 foot by 10 foot high. And on the front side is Kansas and Dorothy Gale's house. And then on the back side is a lovely mural of the Yellow Brick Road going up to the Emerald City. And me and a couple of cast members have had the privilege of scenic painting the show this week. And it's very, very beautiful.
Very, very good. So, China, explain how you and Colin have split up your directorial duties. Are you each, in a sense, focusing on specific aspects of the production, or are you both, in a sense, rowing the same oars towards the same goal?
Yeah, so Colin has been handling a lot more of the scenic design because he was on board before I was. When I came in, I handled a lot more of the actor side of things as far as costuming and getting them, you know, well, stepping, I suppose, and being notes and different things as well. But more doing costumes, scheduling, making sure the munchkins are always very well taken care of as best we can. And kind of doing a little bit more logistics work. I've been working, doing the interviews and kind of different things like that. Yeah, and then I'm also going to get a really cool experience this time of running sound, which I haven't really done before. So we've kind of a little bit had a hand in everything. I also helped with some music rehearsals and some one-on-one coaching for some of the songs and even dipped my hand in some of the choreography at some point. So I've kind of been more of a jack of all trades and sort of filling in wherever there's a need.
Fantastic. That's actually wonderful experience to have. And I was just thinking that it wasn't that long ago, China, that you were on that stage as a performer, because I remember being in the pit for Into the Woods, where you played, I think, one of the nasty stepsisters of Cinderella.
Yes, yes. And then Brian and I both just appeared in Adam's Family, which was the show before this that Colin directed, too. So
you know that stage well. And I suppose in some respects that can be very helpful in terms of knowing that space as a performer and knowing what it's like to be on the other end. Explain, Colin, the makeup of the cast, and if we're talking about a cast of adults or children or some mix of the two.
Yes. So we have 10 munchkins that are 11 to 4 years old. Mm-hmm. We have 2 4-year-olds that during music rehearsals, China actually had to tell them all of the lyrics because they can't read yet.
Wow.
Elementary skills really came into play.
So we have our little munchkin cast, and then we have 2 teenagers that are 12 and 15. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of our cast is 18 plus, and it totals in 25 cast members. And I think our oldest is 65 this year. Mm-hmm. And our youngest is 4 years old. So we have a good mix. And it's a lot of soprano alto voices. So Brian got to work a lot with those sounds. And yeah, it's been really fun. And the cast has helped out a lot around with just like cleaning the theater, setting props, painting. It's really, you get a full experience when you do the theater at the Roadie. So. Yeah,
absolutely. I think that's great. Explain to somebody who really only knows The Wizard of Oz from the movie any significant ways in which this will be different, apart from the fact, of course, that when you watch the movie, you're seeing something on the screen and you're seeing Judy Garland and Bert Lahr and so on. And this obviously is going to be a live performance on the stage, but my recollection is that there are a few differences between how the story unfolds in the film and how it unfolds on the stage, at least typically in most stage adaptions. Are there any surprises you want people to be prepared for in that respect?
Well, we do have one number that is not in the film. It's the Jitterbug. And we did a little bit of research, found out that from what we saw, it was cut originally from the film because they thought it was too spooky, too scary. So we did include that. We still think it's very family friendly, and we presented it in a way that we don't think it's too scary for young audiences.
Rainbow costumes.
Yeah, they are rainbow jitterbugs. But definitely wanted to honor it the way that it was presented. So that was there. There were some unique challenges in the show, I think, being from, you know, over 80 years ago, that it did have some language in it and some sensitive topics in it that we as a directing team had to discuss as far as, like, the crows and different aspects like that. So we had a lot of meetings on being really sensitive with the material and trying to keep it authentic while also trying to modernize it and keep it from not being offensive, since we, you know, have come into a time now where we sort of know better than do, you know, allude towards any, you know, racism or any topics like that. So we did change a couple words and a couple things here and there to update it just a little bit. But we, you know, really took our time combing through everything and trying to make sure that we really found a balance between updating it and staying true to the original show.
Sounds like a very good idea. Brian Chung, as we are talking, we are actually recording this on Tuesday afternoon, so it's still several days to go before opening night. Musically, is everything largely in hand, and is this a moment where it's just the polishing of the staging, or are there certain musical matters you're still thinking about or trying to get even better than they are?
Oh, I'm always thinking about the music, right? I mean, like I said earlier, with like the all the like ancillary like the ahs and oohs that goes on in the background, especially in like in the opening number, there's actually some background singing going on. So those we're always working on. They're already. It's just a matter of like getting them polished and fine-tuned and all that. But this cast has been kicking butt with it.
Ah, glad to hear it. And for you, Colin and China, what remains to be done in these last couple of rehearsals?
I think our biggest polishing moment is just making sure that with this script that is 80 years old, trying to keep it fresh so that audiences don't fall bored or tired or look at the program or go to the bathroom. So still trying to find the humor in some of the lines and the way that our actors are delivering their lines. So just making sure that the tempo and rhythm of the story continues to improve, and making sure that we don't have any dead spaces where we're just reciting lines, which isn't happening. Everyone's always acting, but just making sure that we keep the humor and comedy coming forth through the story.
Very good. China Chung, tell our listeners when The Wizard of Oz opens and how many performances there are.
Yeah, and I just wanted to share one little cool piece of history with you that we found out. So The Wizard of Oz, they did it 10 years ago here at the Roadie. But before that, actually, I think it'd be 82 years ago, Kenosha here at the Roadie Theater hosted the world premiere of The Wizard of Oz, which we found out from some of the cast members who were veteran cast members. So I didn't know if you knew that or not, but I wanted to share that with you, too, that Roadie, cool little piece of Kenosha history, was the world premiere of The Wizard of Oz.
Well, I know that's it's been a little bone of contention, because I forget what there's someplace else in Wisconsin that claims the similar prize, but there is some evidence that points to it being Kenosha versus Manitowoc or Oconomowoc or wherever it was, but some other place. But for sure, the Roadie was one of the very first places, and indeed there is evidence that it might indeed have been the very first or one of the very first to have the Wizard of Oz screening right there in 1939. And you're right, that's a really, really special bit of history, and it's a nice reminder that the Rhodey once upon a time was a very fine movie theater in which films were watched and enjoyed. And now, of course, live theater happens there. So tell us about the performances of Wizard of Oz that are coming up.
Absolutely. So we have, we open Friday, February 3rd. We have an evening performance at 7:30, Saturday 7:30, and then Sunday is our matinee at 2 p.m. The following weekend, it's the same show times, the 10th, 11th, and 12th. And then our last weekend is the 17th and 18th, and they will both be evening shows at 7:30 p.m.
And if people want tickets, can they purchase them at the door, and or is there a way to get them ahead of time?
Both. We have an online ticket sales, and we also have them at the door as well.
Very good. So China Chung and Colin Swanson, co-stage directors of this production of The Wizard of Oz, and Brian Chung, musical director. Thank you to all three of you for making time for this conversation during what I'm sure is a hectic, if not frantic, final week of preparations for your opening tomorrow night of The Wizard of Oz. Best wishes to you and your entire cast.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A few years ago, I think the year was exactly 2005, I had the pleasure of speaking with an actor who actually appeared in that beloved 1939 film version of Frank Baum's The Wizard of Oz. His name, Meinhard Rabi. And Meinhard Rabi was one of the Munchkins. In fact, he portrayed the role of the coroner in the film. And he went on to do other interesting things as well, including a long stint as spokesperson for the Oscar Mayer Company. He wrote a memoir called Memories of a Munchkin, An Illustrated Walk Down the Yellow Brick Road. And here is a portion of our conversation. Tell us how your connection was made with the Wizard of Oz film. I mean, how did that opportunity cross your path?
After working with the Oscar Mayer and Madison in accounting, they transferred me to the corporate office in Chicago, where I heard through the grapevine that MGM was going to make this movie, and they wanted all the little people they could get. And I thought, gee, that might be an interesting experience. So I asked the company for a leave of absence, and I headed to California, and fortunately, as they still needed more, all the little people that showed up were hired into the studio as to be the little people as the Munchkins in The Wizard of Oz.
I know that at one point in the book, you give some credit to child actor Jackie Coogan, I think, in terms of why the decision was made to hire little people and not hire children to portray the Munchkins.
Well, of course, that's corporate information that I wasn't privy to.
Right. But the idea was that there were child labor laws in place in the wake of the work of important child actors like Jackie Coogan, which maybe made it a more viable, practical option for them to use little people, which, of course, worked out so very, very well.
Well, like I say, those decisions were not available to me. That was strictly corporate information.
What was the experience like of stepping into this world as a complete newcomer? Were the vast majority of you newcomers to the world of film?
Well, let's say the scenery and the whole set for the Munchkin Land was really so-called out of this world. It was mind-boggling to someone from, shall we say, ordinary way of life. So it was really a tremendous experience. And, of course, to me, it was very, very interesting because most of the other Munchkins were little people with whom I had worked at the various World Fairs.
Hmm.
So it's like a grand reunion for us.
Well, and you also talk about how this was back in a day when there were hardly any of the gatherings, which take place fairly regularly now, with little people, even conventions and the like. I mean, this had to be a wonderful experience for
it
you
was,
to be
very,
with
very much so.
For you to be with so many other little people.
Like I say, most of them I had worked with previously, so it was renewing old friendships, and shall we say, being with people that we had worked with before, and gathering information as far as their backgrounds, their work experiences.
Hmm. You, of course, were fortunate to be one of maybe 30 or so Munchkins that were given, in the words of one person, special business. I mean, many of the Munchkins were just, you know, we would call them extras on a film set. But
well,
you, of course, and others were given some special roles with which you really had a lot of fun.
Well, the casting director had to pick out the different people. He has certain spots that he needed particular people. And the first ones that he was selected were the three little ladies who were the Lullaby League girls. That was one spot he needed, and there were only three ladies who had toe dancing experience, so they were the first ones to, shall we say, get a top spot.
Hmm. There is some dancing done, of course, by the Munchkins, and some long rehearsals happened for that. Now, did you need to be involved in any of the dancing, or was that something that other Munchkins did?
I'm sorry, say that again.
There was some dancing done by the Munchkins in that scene. Were you one of the Munchkins that had to dance, or didn't you have to worry about that?
No, I was not in that part. They had a special dancing instructor to a choreography who taught the ones selected to do these various dance steps.
One of the things that is mentioned in the book is that the vast majority of the Munchkin lines of dialogue and I think even some of the solo lines sung are actually dubbed in by other actors. Is that right?
That was, of course, shall we say, behind the scenes, that we were not familiar to at the time we were working.
Tell us about the amount of money you were paid.
Well, that again was, shall we say, diminutive, just like we.
It was not quite what you
loved. That was before the unions had had the upper hand in the union in the movie business.
So not a lot of money, but it does sound like, at least for the most part, you were very well treated.
We were very well treated. And let's say it was a wonderful experience, and it, shall we say, gave me the confidence to carry on, and in other words, keep on going, and not worry about being a little person.
Right. You have very warm words of affection for all of the principal actors in the movie, but
well,
you reserve your warmest words really for young Judy Garland.
Very much. She was at the time not quite 16, but she had a wonderful personality, and of course we heard her sing, and she was just very congenial with all the little people. In other words, we had the impression that she got as much of a kick out of being with little people as we did working with her.
Very good. There is, I think we should give a special word of praise to the composers of the Wizard of Oz, because that whole wonderful musical sequence in which you are a part is an absolutely beautifully crafted sequence of songs, hilariously funny and musically so bewitching.
Very, very much the people who composed that music really did a terrific job.
Let's talk for a moment about something else which you address in the book, namely some of the rumors which swirled around that so many of the Munchkins were actually ill-behaved. This is a mistruth that you really try to put to rest in your book.
Sorry, will you repeat that?
I want you to just address the issue of alleged misbehavior by the Munchkins. You, of course, tell us that that wasn't true.
You understand. That was due to the picture that followed, the picture that was specifically made to spoof The Wizard of Oz. In other words, to try and make a fast buck on the reputation of the Wizard of Oz. In other words, the picture over the rainbow, which was absolutely a spoof on The Wizard of Oz, and all the rumors that you speak of originate from that other picture. Not from The Wizard of Oz. A Wizard of Oz, on the set, it was all very tightly scripted, and everybody during the rehearsal, we knew exactly where we had, what yellow brick we had to be on at certain times. In other words, if the director says cut, we had to stay put on that yellow brick where we stopped and be and ready to start out. So we squatted on that same yellow brick, and when he started to shoot again, that's where we started out from.
So this was really a very disciplined set, and the Munchkins were just as disciplined as anyone else.
Correct. It was very well done. You understand, our director, Victor Fleming, after he finished our part, he went on to do, who did another very famous picture, and so that he really made his, shall we say, enlarged his reputation from his success with The Wizard of Oz.
Meinhard Rabi performed the role of the coroner in the 1939 film version of The Wizard of Oz. He passed away in 2010, the last surviving cast member who had dialogue in the film. By the way, Mr. Rabi was born and raised in Watertown, Wisconsin, and the title of his wonderful memoir is Memories of a Munchkin, An Illustrated Walk Down the Yellow Brick Road. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. And to finish out the program, you're going to hear a portion of my conversation with Randall McLowry and Tracy Heather Strain, co-directors and co-producers of a fascinating American Experience documentary titled American Oz, The True Wizard Behind the Curtain, an illuminating look at the life and career of L. Frank Baum, the author of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. The story of Mr. Baum includes some years he spent with his wife in Aberdeen, South Dakota. He moved there in 1888, before South Dakota had even become a state. And in that dusty prairie town, Baum opened an amazing store called Baum's Bazaar, which would give us some hint of the wonderful world he would conjure up in his books about Oz just over a decade later. Randall McLowry describes it.
Baum's Bazaar was basically a luxury store or a novelty store in the middle of the prairie. He was emulating the department stores who were rising in places like Chicago. You know, the Marshall Fields, or a store he specifically references called the Fair. It had all these items, these goods. And at that time, sort of the consumer culture was starting to rise in America. And, you know, the people were able to sort of create their identities through goods, which is very much a part of America today. And Baum, when he was out visiting his brother-in-law, he was looking around, he was thinking about what his future might be and what it would be like in this place. And he basically put on his business person hat and, well, this place has lots of dry goods, you know, feed stores and dry goods stores, but doesn't have something that would, you know, capture the imagination of this growing metropolis, which they believed would become the next Minneapolis or Kansas City or Chicago. And so he felt like this was a need, this was a niche that he could fill. And so he was very methodical, and he had purchased a lot of goods, and he got out there, and within 2 weeks he opens up the store in this grand opening and promising every lady attending a box of chocolates from Chicago. And it really was this place that was represented, I think, in terms of his own imagination, you know, his sense of bringing a sense of uniqueness to their lives by being able to purchase these things and bringing joy. And I think that was a lot of part of what he wanted to do. He wanted to make people happy in many different ways. And he thought this would help. And he thought also that this would be a way that he can make money and sustain his family, which at, up to that point was sort of, in some ways, I think his, or it always, I think, was kind of always weighing on him, you know, and certainly we talk about in the film that his mother-in-law was always worried he would not be able to do that because of his, you know, he wasn't embarking into professions that necessarily would provide the support that would maintain that support for a family.
But in another way, it's a fascinating story because on the one hand, he was methodical and he was, you know, he loved being there. He told kids stories there. It was, he liked the idea of making it kind of a center of town. But on the other hand, we are in the midst of it's a prairie town and mostly farmers are surrounding. And so as you know, in the film, the weather, a drought comes. Who's going to buy fancy goods in a drought when eating is going to be the priority, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, he just happened to hit it a period of time where there wasn't a drought, right? He wasn't thinking ahead about what do I do if bad times come. Mm. I don't think that was necessarily how he thought.
Right. Ever the optimist. And I think your film comes as close as we can possibly come to understanding what this amazing store was like. And even though I'm sure no photographs exist of what it looked like inside, but I think you do a wonderful job of kind of recreating the sense of wonder that one had to have when you walked through the doors and experienced this. But as you've already hinted at, this awful drought, the worst that America had ever seen, leads to the store having to shut down. And Mr. Baum turns his attention to writing. One of the things you touch on in this chapter of the film is that this is also a very turbulent period in terms of the displacement of Native Americans from their own land. And things become very tense and painful at certain points. And we're presented with the really unhappy reality of Mr. Baum having some of his own ideas about Native Americans turning very dark and twisted. We'll leave it to our listeners to experience it thoroughly in the film, but could you just say a word about what it was like to have to deal with this kind of unhappy side of who L. Frank Baum was and what you thought about in terms of trying to present this as fairly as you could?
So I think, and this obviously, you know, I think is part of what we, you know, in terms of thinking about him as a complicated person, you know, he does have some very hurtful and unfathomable words that he writes about Native Americans around the time of Wounded Knee, which was a very dark period in American history. And, you know, I think our approach is understanding the context of the times and understanding where he comes from in terms of his own background and what was seen as, you know, his ideas about Native Americans was not unique. His idea about Native Americans was actually probably much more prevalent in terms of how society or white society viewed Native Americans and, you know, the ideas of extermination. And he's looking at, in terms of how you sort of think about what his choices were in terms of what he wrote. I mean, he wrote two editorials that were unspeakable in many respects. And while he was echoing thoughts that were part of the American ideology, or at least the white American ideology at the time, I mean, these are obviously things that he bought into. And while he was in many ways progressive in his attitudes towards women and spoke about tolerance in his newspaper and how he saw America as a tolerant place, he you know, didn't associate that with Native Americans.
Yeah, and we also see that this is the American experience, you know. I mean, not literally because the program, but this is who we are as Americans. And I think the sooner we all embrace the realities of who we are as a country, who we have been, we're never going to ever change. If we want to, you can't sit back with your head in the sand and deny that this person didn't say that or they didn't mean this. you know, oh, you're reading it wrong. That's not helpful. And we can't apologize for people. It's important to say people are, as you said, complicated, and people are cultures of their time, but that doesn't like take them off the hook, you know, because as Randy's pointed out, he was tolerant about some things, but then, you know, when economic interests hit or self-interest hit, you know, sometimes that's when people show who they are, at least aspects, certain aspects of who they are. So I think it wasn't like a hard decision or anything to include. It would have been, I think, a terrible decision not to include it.
I quite agree. I appreciate the frankness and honesty with which you address this. You also don't rush past it. You also don't, it seems to me at least, you don't unduly dwell on it. I mean, this is one part of who he was, but it does not consume, in a sense, all of who he was. There were other things about him of more admirable characteristics, and I think you are completely fair and open as you try to help us understand this man and his complications. So when things eventually kind of fall apart out on the prairie for Mr. Baum and his family, they resettle in the amazing city of Chicago. And I so appreciate the time that your film takes to describe Chicago at this point in time. And in particular, the amazing Chicago World's Fair that opens in 1893. Just briefly say a word about how this seems to have been a tremendous source of inspiration for L. Frank Baum when he, some years later, writes The Wonderful Wizard of Oz.
Yes, so the World's Fair was an incredible moment, and certainly what it presented. I mean, it was, at the time, you know, it was probably one of the most visited and most talked about events, certainly in America, and if not the world at that time. And I'd have to go back, but you know, millions of people showed up for the opening. And it was, or a quarter of a million people showed up for the opening. I should double check my, I should know that off the top of my head, but I'd have to go back and look at the script to clarify my exact, the exact number. But it really was presenting, and I think what was really captivating for somebody like Baum was this, the imagination and sort of the amazing new inventions that were being presented there, things, the electricity building, you know, somebody like Thomas Edison, who was, you know, also called the Wizard of Menlo Park. This was a transformative time in American history. I mean, it was also a moment that was also trumpeting sort of the rise of America as a power, both in terms of within the United States, but also as a world power, and sort of presenting sort of the rise of Western civilization. But I think, you know, for Baum, there was a sense of possibilities that were presented there, a sense of, you know, things to come in the future. And I think it really, you know, ignited his imagination to think about that. And you know, we do talk about that, while we don't know for definitively, but, you know, the World's Fair was known as the White City because it was these beautiful neoclassical buildings that were all painted white and just sort of had this sort of glow to it. And the idea that there was this, almost this, the ideal city, this sort of not necessarily utopia, but, and Oz, Emerald City in Oz is seen as potentially as an inspiration from what was presented at Chicago's World's Fair and the White City. And so those kinds of senses of imagination, of possibilities, are the things that I think really grew Frank Baum into that moment and into that world, into the World's Fair. And I think it gave him that sense of, you know, reaching beyond sort of, you know, what your everyday world is, and to see things beyond that.
Right. Reaching beyond the ordinary, which right. Of course he very much did. In a sense, though, when it came time to actually sit down and do some writing and try to achieve success as a writer, your film tells us that it was, in a sense, for the most ordinary of reasons that L. Frank Baum wanted this for himself, and it had a lot to do with his family. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, by the time he was writing for children. He had four kids and he was on the road a lot, and he would come home and tell them stories and to entertain them, to be with them. And his mother-in-law, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, encouraged him to write those stories down. She was published, and she had a sense that, you know, he could do something with these great stories that he was spinning for his children.
And it would be a way to not be on the road as an exhausted right. traveling salesman. I mean, I just love that in a sense it was for such a ordinary kind of reason that he ended up sitting down and doing this.
But I also think that the fact that he was out there traveling and seeing the country, you know, I think that it provided him with, in essence, you know, grist for his imagination, and seeing these different people and seeing these different landscapes. And certainly he had, you know, the landscape of the prairie obviously informed the Wonderful Wizard of Oz in the first chapter, and, you know, the world of Kansas and sort of the drought that he witnessed out in Dakota, you know, was very directly an inspiration for the Kansas that Dorothy grew up in. But I think it also sort of, we kind of imagine sort of the idea that when you're, you know, on a train and things are passing by, that's kind of like, it allows your imagination to sort of continue. We don't know that that's necessarily how he did, but the idea that he was in hotels and he would be writing things down on every little pieces of paper. He was just kind of constantly, I think, being bombarded with new places and new faces and, you know, different experiences that then, I think, led him into things like with the Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which was this creation of great different groups of people and different types of people. And Dorothy's journey is a world of discovery of different and encountering different people on her way, trying to get back home, which, of course, if you look at Frank Baum and his effort to want to get back home and to be at home, you can, you know, see sort of connections between his life and what he does translate into that story.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I was going to add about the train when you just jumped in with that. It's like, we used to ride the train a lot. We used to live in Boston. We rode the Northeast Corridor trains a lot. And I've even ridden the trains out to the Midwest at times, like right after 9/11, when the planes were grounded, I actually took a train trip to out in the Midwest. And, you know, it used to be, before everyone had a laptop, you would sit there and you'd look out and you would think. And I remember getting a lot of work done and writing down on the train. We imagined that was the case before. And so if you will notice that in the film, there's a lot of train. I mean, that was a major way of transportation, of course, but there's something about that rhythm and the changing scenery. And I do recall that a few years ago, Amtrak had started a program, you know, so that writers could like, right across the country. You know, there's something about that movement and writing and thinking that we wanted to capture in this film.
Tracy Heather Strain and Randall McLowry's American Experience documentary, American Oz, can still be viewed at pbs.org. And one more reminder that the Lakeside Players production of The Wizard of Oz opens tomorrow night at the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a conversation from The Morning Show archives. Many of you have probably heard of the major motion picture that has just been released called 80 for Brady, about four older women who are all vociferous NFL fans and fans of quarterback Tom Brady. They're played by Lily Tomlin, Rita Moreno, Sally Field, and Jane Fonda. Tomorrow we'll hear the conversation I recorded several years ago with Patricia Bodsworth, author of a book about Jane Fonda called Jane Fonda, The Private Life of a Public Woman. That will be tomorrow on The Morning Show. And this weekend, in the podcast version of The Morning Show, we're going to be paying memorial tribute to Dr. Yuri